All right. Well, Shay, thank you so much for sitting down with me. Yeah. The name of the series is All Roads Lead to Pullman. Something I love about our community is that everybody is here on purpose. Nobody comes to Pullman by accident, right? Either came for a job or a degree or, you know, something to make life better. And so I love hearing people's stories. What brought them to the Palouse? What brought you to our amazing community?
Oh, God. How far do you want me to go back?
As far back as you feel.
I remember where it like started steamrolling and I was like, oh, geez, where the heck am I going to end up? And then it was like, bam, here.
So do you have roots in this region or did you come from afar?
You know, I actually asked myself that same question not long ago and I really can't place where I had roots.
Hmm.
I guess it's sort of an unusual story. I don't have a childhood home. I don't really have a house that I grew up for most of my childhood. I think like the closest thing was probably when I was living in Southern California. I grew up in a migrant community. So we lived in the middle of a very wealthy region, very wealthy city. And we were the little community that got our electricity and our water shut off pretty regularly.
Oh, wow.
And while everyone else had theirs on. But then we'd get city alerts saying like, oh, you know, the water shortage today. So that was kind of my childhood. Wow. And I spent most of my time running around the mountains. So, but.
And that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it was a good time for sure. I learned a lot out there. But, you know, so a lot of my formative years were either in Southern California in Santa Monica Mountains or on the beach because it was the dollar to get there. And we had like just school bus would take us every summer. Or I spent nearly a decade in the Midwest. In a very rural part of Missouri where my father grew up. It's mostly a prison town and an old lead mining institution. And, you know, the mining's not there anymore, but the town is left behind. So a lot of my formative years were sort of in these very marginalized, disparaged places. And I never really felt like I truly had, like, a home. I would try to make it home. And, you know, I had my kids from an early age, so... I was 19 when I had my first, so we were sort of just growing up together.
Wow.
But I spent a little bit of time here in Washington State. I lived in the islands over in San Juan Islands. And, you know, my family, my mother's roots, who I grew up with my mother most of the time, was in the Philippines. So I spent a couple years in the Philippines during the pandemic.
Yeah, I was listening to the Lee Women Voters Forum, and you specifically said, ask me about it sometime.
Yeah.
So tell me, what was it like going through COVID in the Philippines?
Do you really want to know?
I really want to know.
I feel a little bad because I think it kind of puts other countries on high alert for what they should do next time. We did really well.
Tell me more.
Really well. So I like to look into how societies collapse and... oftentimes, the crux of it is what does our food accessibility look like? And as soon as things shut down, like the day before, people got onto Facebook, people got onto communicating with their neighbors because they're like, we don't know what's going to happen. How do we prepare? And we set up this like digital network of everyone having access to something and providing it for low cost.
Yeah.
And so everybody got in contact with their aunties and their cousins and, you know, friends who lived on the outskirts of town who had a garden accessible to them. We have pigs and roosters just sort of naturally in the urban environment. And, you know, all of our food waste went to the pigs or the roosters. And then everybody else, we still practice social distancing, but we set up markets or we put it on digitally. Like, this is what I have available. Would you like some? Do you want to trade? And so I would cook food and I would trade for that. Or other people would just like trade their own goods for, you know, you had like tons of stuff. I mean, like I walk into the market here and this is not half of what people were growing in their gardens back in the Philippines. And I mean, it's beneficial that it's a rainforest.
Right? Climate matters a lot.
Climate does matter a lot.
That's some incredible community resiliency.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love that.
Even healthcare, like doctors and nurses would make house calls to test people. And if somebody tested positive for COVID, then that alert went on our digital platform and people would bring medicine or food to their door so they didn't have to leave.
Wow.
So it was like real community cohesiveness. And
I love that.
It was brilliant.
Just a couple of years ago, we lost one essential service for a month, which was the natural gas outage.
Oh, God.
And that were you here for that?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. No, I was.
You remember
when it first got
cold and all that. And like, that was not a major disruption to our food supply. And yet there was panic.
Yeah.
And it just shows how vulnerable we are and why we need those kind of community centric resources and be prepared to help each other out as neighbors. I've oftentimes thought, you know, since I moved to some acreage outside of town, like what could I do in the event of some sort of natural disaster? Like, you know, what could we host? What could we grow? I'd love to see more food being grown locally. And yeah. Anyway, I'm sure we'll get into that. So in the Philippines for COVID, what eventually brought you out here to the Palouse?
Well, the stability that we had during the pandemic there was very different. You know, we had armed guards who made us stay inside. So all transportation shut down as well, unless it was essential.
Wow.
The skies cleared up. Oh, I have this photo. I can show it to you afterwards. But it's like within a month and a half, it's like, where did we get those extra mountain ranges? Have those been there the entire time? This is beautiful. You can hardly see the KFC sign in the distance. And, but, you know, it, see, this is what I was talking about. What was the question?
What eventually brought you to Pullman?
Oh, eventually brought me to Pullman. So, you know, we couldn't leave, and that left us with a lot of time. And you know, accepting rent shut down, accepting money for utility shut down, all these services just stayed on. And so now I'm not saying it was a utopia. It was obviously, it was a pandemic that rattled everybody. And so there were complications, people died, and we weren't able to get our vaccines for months. And so because of that, we stayed indoors, and I was like, well, you know, maybe this is prime time to go back to school. And so I checked online, and it turns out I was still sort of enrolled in a community college back in Kansas where I lived.
Oh, wow.
And so this is Johnson County Community College. I actually did a paper on it, a little like news story on it, because they found out that I was overseas and I was doing my classes at 2 a.m., 4 a.m. in the morning. I'm like half awake and everyone's like, oh, I just got done with lunch. But so I graduated summa cum laude after finishing my Associates of Science in General Science online. And then I was like, well, see if we can go a little further. Like the Associates was, it took me so long that it felt good enough for me. And then I just started looking for other things. And I started getting really excited about programs. And I applied to UW.
Oh.
I applied to WSU.
Yay.
And I applied to Mount Holyoke, and there was another women's college, Scripps.
Did you know anything about WSU when you applied?
The wonderful community of Reddit had this one guy who had posted a video about him riding his motorbike through the Palouse with a video camera on the front. And I thought it was the coolest thing. I was like, what is this place?
It is gorgeous.
It's so flat, but it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Flat and yet not flat somehow at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. But I just, you know, I couldn't stop watching that video, and I just kept reading up more and more and more about it. And I was really excited about medical anthropology. And Dr. Marcia Quinlan is a professor here at WSU. And since then, I have taken several of her classes, and she and I are pretty close. But I'm close in like the professor student sense. Yeah. They're like not really close at all. Distance between emails and countries, because
school like WSU, you really can get to know your faculty members, which is awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I just applied, and WSU accepted me, and then they offered me a scholarship to pay for. It was a good chunk of change for me. So, I started kind of going through the motions like, well, if this happens, then maybe I'll go. Okay, if this happens, then maybe I'll go. Because I still had my husband at the time and my children. And we were all there in like this 32 square meter apartment, which is, I don't know if you can visualize that.
32 square meters.
Yeah. Okay. It's like maybe, oh gosh, math is not my strong suit. I had to take it like 7 times. But I think it's probably like 300 square
feet. Yeah, that's like, it's you know, one bedroom apartment.
Yes, but two bedrooms smooshed into it.
Two small bedrooms.
Yes, two small bedrooms, yeah.
Wow. So what was your first impression coming out here to Pullman? When you saw it for the first time?
Yeah, wow, things smell different here.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not like a bad thing.
But it's different than the Philippines.
Very different than the Philippines. And I did miss the fruit trees. But since then, I have found more fruit trees to replace that spot in my heart. But yeah, it was amazing. And I think the first impression that I got was the people. I was hired. I think the thing that really solidified it, that was like, yeah, I'm going to leave my family for 4 months so I can get set up here, and then we're going to bring you all over later. Things got really backed up in the government in the Philippines for, you know, obvious reasons. But it was taking a long time to process any kind of paperwork for people to leave because a lot of us couldn't renew our visas. And so we weren't going to be deported or barred from staying in the country, but it did take a long time. And so I had to go ahead, leave my kids and my husband back in the Philippines. And I was here for 4 months. And so during that time, I was like, this is really lonely. I was in the dorms, you know, it's like 8x10 closet and like a little like flat bed about that thick.
Yeah,
just trying to make
college dorms.
Yeah, college dorms. Yeah, you know, I think they intend to have you not spend a ton of time there. But I met people from the Center for Civic Engagement. I had gotten on with a position through AmeriCorps. And so I was, my official title, which I never used, was the Police Fresh Food Project Coordinator. And so right off the bat, all of the people I was working with were these just amazing folks who had been doing work in their community for just years and, you know, making sure that our volunteer network was running and that there was like true collaborative energy between the university and the local community. And I was like, this is, I mean, like, I loved what happened in the Philippines, but this is what I was hoping for in the U.S. And it's something that I felt like I had really missed out for most of my life, missed out on them for the rest of most of my life before I had left the country, the first time. So, I mean, I've got a lot of good things to say about Pullman.
Yeah, tell me more about that. What do you love about our community?
Everything.
For example?
The diversity, for one.
Yes.
This is really one of the most diverse places I've ever lived in.
For rural Western North America?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of languages spoken in just one little zip code.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I find people from my country too. And awesome. Like, that's hard to do. Not just the diversity, but the connections that you can see various groups trying to build, like our Bangladeshi community, our Indian community. We have a lot of students from different places in Africa. You name it, whatever Asian, you know, group you want to put yourself into, you can probably find it here. And I've never really encountered something like that before.
Oh, it's one of my favorite things about our town, right? Like to be able to be in a rural part of America, but have access to world culture and just, you know, to get outside of the bubble is really nice. I love raising my kids here where they can have not just friends, but people they can look up to from other countries with other experiences and other languages. It's amazing.
Yeah. And the connection with our indigenous communities too.
Yeah.
I mean, that is.
No, that's very present here.
The Pacific Northwest is like,
Yeah.
I mean,
you can make an argument that this is the youngest part of the nation of the United States, like the last part to be colonized.
Yes.
Right. You can make that case because a lot of people on the Oregon Trail, when they made it this far, they just kept going and then worked their way backwards. Right. Like it's not that far back. And that having that history so close and to have the people here as our friends and neighbors. I love that.
Yeah. Would you like a fun fact about the Oregon Trail from a personal
experience? I would love that. Yes.
Yeah. So I was in professional archaeology before I went into my PhD program.
Oh, that's fascinating. We could talk for an hour just about that.
We could, yeah. I mean, don't let me get off topic.
You're good.
It'll spend hours. They'll have a lot to cut out.
Yeah.
But we had to take like a deviation because there was a guy local to where our project was, and he wanted us to find a portion of the Oregon Trail out in the Oregon High Desert.
Okay.
And
yeah, you can still see the ruts out there in the soil.
Yeah. And so I don't think we actually placed it correctly, but the journey and like the hunting for it was so cool.
Amazing.
And at some point, I think I wandered into like a carnivore's den because there was just like bits of animal everywhere. I was like half eaten. And I was like, oh, I'm going to, you know, you can't really be like, excuse me, sir, these are unsafe conditions. Like I have to be out there and like log where everything is. And so that was fun, you know, but it's really interesting to just be out in the middle of nowhere and look around and there's desert for miles. The closest town is like 2 hours away. Like even like a small, small town is like very, very far off in the distance. And you're taking roads that haven't been roads for a really long time just to find another road that also hasn't been a road for a very long time. So that's my fun fact.
Love it. Love it. So anthropology, is that your area of study?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What fascinates you about that field?
Also, how far do you want to go back out there? My mom was, I can't say that word on the air, probably. But, you know, she was really hard on me in particular. Not necessarily my brother. My brother was more sports. But she was very hard on me when it came to academics and understanding literary works. And so when we first moved to California, after she left my father, she went to an estate, because like I said, it was a very wealthy area, and she bought this huge leather-bound collection of just about anything you can imagine as far as literary works go. Britannicas, encyclopedias. She had this Britannica Medical Almanac from 1986 to 1994. So it was like fairly recent for the time, because I think we moved there in 96, just after the Northridge earthquake. And dictionaries, thick leather-bound dictionaries.
Oh, what a
treat. Works of Shakespeare. Oh, yeah. Like, I didn't know who Voltaire was, but they had a book. I don't think I ever dipped into that one, but...
That's some heady stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, the Odyssey, the Iliad, I mean, all sorts of classics. And, I mean, I already loved to read, so I just, like, her thing was, all right, this is your reading time. There's no television. Go for it. And the thing that I was drawn to the most was the collection of medical and almanacs. And I read every single one, cover to cover. And I loved medicine so much. I loved human anatomy. I really loved like how it affects public health and, you know, how we perceive ourselves as beings, all the little intricate workings that make us, you know, physical and metaphysical was just so interesting to me. And so it never stopped, and it just sort of steamrolled. And I think there was like a period of time where I was going through my education and I was so angry about the world. I was like, why can't we just do it a little bit better? You know, like we've got people to take care of. Why can't we just take care of people the way we should in medicine? And that anger turned into motivation, which turned into something, thankfully, a little bit more positive. And that's how I got into medical anthropology. And archaeology was always sort of a hobby. And like, I really like thinking about stuff that had been in the past. And then I realized that there was such a strong connection between the two. You know, the past doesn't always define us, but it does guide us. And that's sort of something that I've always held on to is like, okay, medical anthropology and archaeology are like, it's important to know who your ancestors were and what they were doing. And so we don't lose that knowledge.
Yeah.
There's so much tacit knowledge in these previous generations that we're losing due to convenience, due to, you know, manufactured ignorance. I mean, you name it.
And loss of language.
Loss of language. I mean, yeah. I took a linguistics class with Dr. Quinlan, and it's something like we had 6,000 active languages in the world. A lot of them don't even have writing to go along with them.
Yeah.
And within the next decade or so, we're bound to lose about 80% of them.
Wow.
And it's from the universalization of easy languages, easy to
right.
learn,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
To perpetuate globalization, but at what cost?
Yeah.
So
it's the cycle of, in some ways, empire, yeah. right? You know, you get end up with these universal languages and we lose so much in the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's amazing hearing your backstory and what brought you here. I'm so glad that you found your people. And yeah. you're able to like, oh, this is home. So what then prompted you to want to run for public office and get involved in city government?
It's actually a funny story. My family and I had left during the first administration. Kansas, just as a Midwestern town.
The first administration.
So when Trump was first elected.
Trump 45.
Yeah, Trump 45, yeah. But things were not particularly safe in the Midwest. And we left the country. There were some things that happened with my daughter. She was 13 at the time. And it was like very clearly racially charged. And we had already planned on leaving before then, but this was just sort of like the kick out the door.
Yeah, last straw.
Yeah. And it made me really evaluate what I was willing to fight for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was the person who was like, oh, I hate politics. Like, can we just stop talking about it already? And because it always gets so heated and it rip people apart and people are so like strong in their views and their values. They don't want to have that conversation or see compromise. It's like, if my identity exists, well, then yours cannot. And how can we argue for only my identity to exist?
Right.
And that's what it felt like every single conversation. And so, you know, I thought about it and I watched the election and I participated in the election. And then when I was in the Philippines, I started writing down, how can we do this better?
Yeah.
And so I had like this really weird, I don't know, it was like some bank ledger or something. I got it from one of the, we call them Sadi Sadi. So like the little convenience store down the street. And it was like literally just someone's apartment and their kitchen window. And but I wrote down policies of what I thought we could do better.
Yeah.
And that sort of flowed over with me when I came to WSU. And I just kept on doing it. It was like my journaling exercise.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like, okay, what's happening in our town? What can we do a little bit better? What am I doing right now? How can I do more?
Yeah. Can we unpack that a little bit? Because, you know, we're now in Trump 47.
Yeah.
On part two. And I mean, let's just acknowledge there's very little we can do immediately to affect federal policy.
Yeah.
But we can still be a welcoming community despite what's happening in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
What are we getting right? I'm looking for feedback. Right, as someone who's been here for 25 years, what are we as the community of Pullman doing well in welcoming international or marginalized communities, and what could we do better?
Well,
please.
There's a huge difference between being a bystander during critical issues and an upstander, where you recognize that there's something happening and it may not directly affect you. It might not affect you at all. You might not perceive it to affect you, and it may even contradict your beliefs. But when you realize that somebody is being injured by it, being harmed by it, and there's a lot of pain involved, stepping up to say, maybe we should look at something different, or can we do something different, or actively engaging in doing something different just to understand better, I think that would be really beneficial for everybody. I have a long history of volunteering. And so, you know, regardless of people's political views, people develop their political views for a variety of reasons. And oftentimes it's because that's all they know and that's all that they can relate to as a person.
Well, it's that their background affects their.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, like, finding a way to meet in this ethical space. I don't know if you're familiar with Willie Ermine. He's an indigenous scholar, and he talks about the meeting of two societies, two very distinct communities. And there's a space in between them where they have this opportunity to say, you have your history, I have my history. Can we talk about that? And, you know, something that may benefit you may not benefit me, but it's still for the good of our community when we help that to blossom. Because flourishing is mutual.
Yeah.
And
So what are we doing well, and what can we improve on here in the community of Pullman?
I think we're already doing that.
Yeah.
You know, I think...
For example.
So can you think of some nonprofit organizations in town off the top of your head that you've seen around?
Many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably like the Community Action Center.
Yeah, definitely.
Is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Oasis for our LGBTQ folks, which is in Idaho, but they still help Pullman. Mm-hmm. Alternatives to Violence on the Palouse. Yeah. You know, because more now than ever, there have been a lot of reports of violence in the home. Mm-hmm. And intimate partner violence is just like kind of out of control globally.
Wow.
And so all of these groups and the Intersectional Advocacy Coalition, you know, all of these groups are already doing the good work. Mm-hmm. you know, and they've kind of started to come together in a way that synthesizes the needs of the community, and they're engaging people who normally weren't engaged before.
Yeah.
And bringing them out and getting them involved, even if it's just to like hang out and have a good time, not necessarily take like action, like, you know, go stand out on the corner and rally and whatever else, which is exactly what I do. But you know, like building these connections and rekindling relationships, or, you know, starting a small fire where there wasn't one before, you know, in terms of relationships between two groups.
Yeah.
And, you know,
metaphorical fire.
Metaphorical fire. Good fire, right? There's you have good fire.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Healing, culturally practiced fire. Yeah. That
gathering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. So what's your vision for city council? What made you go, I think I should be up there on that platform?
Well, when I saw that he was up for re-election, this is probably going back to the first.
He being.
And Trump was
so
up for.
Federally. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Was up for a second election. I was already here, and I had a bunch of friends who had heard about my policy journaling, and they were like, you know, it'd be funny if you just ran. And I was like, yeah, that would be funny. You know, who's going to elect a little brown girl, you know, for president? Like, no one's going to do that right now, especially not, you know, someone like me. And so we like laughed about it. And, you know, I was still going through my classes, and people would stop me in the halls and ask me stuff about the food pantry that I had worked on and other things that I was engaged in the community. And it kept happening and kept happening and kept happening. And my friends are like, who are you? Like, you're involved in all these things. Like, you should just run for president. And it stopped being a joke.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why? I don't know what it takes. And so I looked it up, and it was like, I have all the qualifications to do this. And I mean, you know, by the federal government standards.
Right, right. Yeah.
And whether or not whether or not I feel qualified is another story. But it's free to register.
That's true.
And so I registered to run for the 2024 presidency.
Seriously.
Just for funsies.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I've got like, you know, business cards and whatever. But yeah.
I mean, I don't think I've ever met a presidential candidate in person.
So it was like 400.
I'm honored to meet you.
Yeah. The list was actually pretty long. There were a lot of, I mean, you have that one guy.
You got to add that to my resume now. I have now interviewed a presidential candidate.
Have you heard of like Vermin Supreme?
I don't think so.
He's been running for probably, I don't know, like 20 years or something.
Oh, okay.
But this guy.
One of those kinds.
But yeah, I mean, like, it's you as long as you have the bare minimum qualifications, you can run for president. So, yeah. But this guy, Vermin Supreme, has been running for, I don't know, like 20 years or something. Yeah. He's got a boot on his head, and his platform is everybody gets a pony.
Okay, I have seen those pictures. Okay, but I assume that you're not running for Pullman City Council as a stunt.
No, not at all.
You strike me as a serious candidate.
I hope so. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, what started as a joke started to turn into something where it's like, well, I'm already involved in all of these things, so why not?
Yeah.
And so when I was doing a lot of the organizing for Indivisible Palouse, mm-hmm. people were like, have you considered running for local office? We have an election coming up, and, you know, we need people like you. And I thought that was weird. They're like, you're so inspiring. And I just saw a clip from I can't remember her name, but she's an Asian comedian. And she talks about like how you don't want to be inspiring. That means something bad happened to you. She's like, that's not good to be inspiring. You had trauma. And I was like, well, yes, but you know, how can I use it? So yeah, I mean, it was kind of my own personal call to action. When three people asked me, I was like, I should probably at least try.
Awesome.
And, you know, a dear friend of mine was talking about how a lot of our previous elections have gone uncontested.
Some.
Occasionally.
So yeah. Occasional. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the majority, but it happens every so often.
Yeah. And I think probably this many candidates running is not typical.
We haven't had this many candidates run in the time that I've lived here. Since this is pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I think this is
very busy at this table.
I bet. I heard, yes. And that's the cool thing about it, too, is like, you know, I think several of the candidates, we're pretty close.
Yeah.
No.
I've seen the pictures online. That's pretty adorable. The Ward 3 Musketeers.
Yeah. I haven't confided in them whether or not they accept that, but I thought it was cute. So
I liked it. So what's your vision for city council? Like, assuming you win that seat, what's your vision for being for representing Ward 3?
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people might push back on this, but I don't view economic growth as a pure necessity right now. I think that uninhibited growth can be very dangerous in a lot of aspects. You have something invasive and it grows out of control. It swallows up everything else.
That's cancer.
It's cancer. Yeah. Yeah. Your free radicals just go crazy. And I think that stability more now than ever is really key.
Yeah.
So I want to
unpack that a little bit, like stability in what, what areas, what issues?
So we don't have to have like a constantly growing pot of money. We just need to have a stable, accessible pot of money while we're disseminating that accessibility to our local community. Mm-hmm. You know, like where are our marginalized communities within Coleman? Who is hurting the most? I think somebody asked me recently about like homelessness initiatives and like what, oh yeah, the League of Women Voters, you know, like what, would I approve funding our homelessness initiatives more or our parks and green spaces, both of which I think are critically important. And right now, we're leaning so hard on our nonprofit groups that they're being so bogged down with it, they can't do anything else, even in their personal lives. And so we have to come together as a community, and I want to help build that.
Yeah.
Want to be part of the civic engagement portion.
Yeah.
You know, like we have all of these really amazing organizations already, you know, built up and offering these opportunities to get involved and to meet your neighbors and to see your neighbor flourish. Yeah. And when that happens, you flourish too. You know, like how can we bring people who are making big decisions for the community and making big bucks off of it
right
down to the local level, where they're hanging out with us too. And
well, let's delve into that a little bit, because you know, a nonprofit is receiving unrestricted funds that they can do whatever they want within their mission. A government entity is using taxpayer money.
Yeah.
There's a lot more strings attached to there.
Yeah.
So where, in your opinion, where's the line between what a nonprofit is best at and what a government entity is best at? Like, there's some things we've decided the government is going to be in charge of, and there's other things not. And some of those things are up for debate.
Yeah.
It sounds like you would like to see city government involved in a few more things. What are some examples?
Yeah. So I think that any government is critical to fostering good social determinants of health.
Yeah.
And it's already laid out in civil planning. And, you know, like healthcare networks, there's no reason that a city council member can't go through those and be like, all right, how are the decisions we are making impacting these social determinants of health? And
for example,
you know, we've got 75% of our population. I think I said this at the League of Women Voters, 75% of our population, or approximately there, are renters. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you rent your lot because you own your mobile home, or because you're a student here and you're going to be here for maybe 2 to 4 years, or if you're a PhD student and you want to stay here longer, you know, there are a lot of rental focused initiatives. And oh gosh, I'm scared to dip my toes into this because I wish I knew more about it.
Sure.
The short-term rental.
The Airbnb.
The
short-term rental ordinance that was passed recently.
Yeah. And so I was there for that conversation. And I think it was Nathan Weller who talked about, you know, like, well, short-term rentals, why aren't we looking at long-term rentals? And it's like, well, that's the thing. We should be looking at both. And you're comparing two different entities. But they are still linked in a way, you know, because the way that we interact and regulate our short-term rentals directly impacts the availability for our long-term residents.
Yeah.
And if we really...
Very different customer base. Short-term rentals tend to be outside community, whereas long-term rentals tend to be our friends and neighbors.
Yeah.
But it's the same housing stock.
Exactly. And the focus for short-term rentals is mainly on tourism, economic...
Luxury amenities.
Economic growth, really, is like, you know, bringing that vitality back to the city. But it's like, if you push everybody out with short-term rentals, then... who does the vitality actually go to?
Everything has consequences.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's like, you know, I think that the regulations are reasonable. Mm-hmm. I think that I wouldn't
want... The ordinance.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to stay in a place short-term or long-term that didn't have basic safety measures in place. Carbon monoxide detectors, smoke detectors, fire.
That seems like, in my opinion, it's a reasonable thing. It's one trip to Home Depot.
Yeah.
And it's probably good for us to have a list of where they are just from a public safety perspective.
Yeah. And to have somebody double check. Right. The issue here and where I worry about what our city is going to be able to do is enforcing it. Yeah. And so that's one of the things is like we need to have people who are dedicated to enforcing those regulations. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you get companies who come in and buy up mobile home lots, for example.
Well, and that's the real value of this ordinance is that, you know, right now, short-term rentals in Pullman is kind of a cottage industry. It's a side hustle for a lot of people that are not necessarily wealthy, right? They're just, you know, supplement their income. The scenario that we're trying to guard against hasn't happened yet, which is where you have some outside investor come up and buy up a whole city block, you know, and take dramatic amount of housing out of the public market. Mm-hmm. That's the scenario we're trying to avoid. And if we don't have that ordinance in place now, we won't be able to enforce it later.
Yeah.
You know, cities have had a lot of trouble trying to push back against that style of development because they didn't do the ordinances early on. The example I like to say is if you don't pass an ordinance about wind farms before someone wants to build one, it's kind of hard to do anything about it. So this is really preventative lawmaking, like preventative medicine more than anything else.
Absolutely. And that's what it should be, right? You know,
we're not trying to kill the Airbnb market.
Yes, exactly. It's like, I know that's when I first got here, I stayed in an Airbnb and it was delightful. But the person who was renting to me for that period of time lived in the home.
Mm.
Like we had the opportunity to sit and talk together and get to know each other.
Which is cool.
And that's also in the ordinance, you know, is like making sure that the owner of the property is within a 30-minute window helping with any emergencies.
Owners, not out of town.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Well, kind of going back to the economic vitality versus stability thing that you brought up, I think that's an interesting way of looking at things, and I agree in a lot of ways. Right now, Pullman has a balanced budget. We're not running a surplus. We're not running a deficit. We have a balanced budget.
Yeah.
So when we talk about things like increasing funding for parks and rec, which can we all agree, our parks are awesome. We love our trail system. Like, it's great, right?
Yeah.
But if we actually did want to, right now and with our current budget situation, if we wanted to increase funding for something like parks and rec, it would have to come out of something else.
Yeah.
So in your case, what would you be okay with doing without in order to put more funding towards parks and rec, like you shared it at the forum?
Yeah. So, you know, that's the juggle. And just personally from experience, being from a very low income household pretty much my entire life, that's our eternal juggle, is you're always in a deficit. Doesn't matter if you're working 70 hours a week or 40 hours a week, there's always a bill that might have to go unpaid for a little bit. Something that might have to be a little underfunded, but then you cycle back around to it. I mean, it's a priority list. And I mean, I would like to take a look at where everything is allocated to make that decision.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is a technique there where it's like, you know, we should be good for a little bit in this bucket if we allocate a bit to our parks and funding for this year. And then next year when it comes around, okay, we have to focus on this. And, you know, we can... everything else can keep its budget, but let's go ahead and put a little bit more into this bucket so that...
Sure. So you're advocating for like cyclical, big investment in various things on a rolling basis as opposed to baseline funding.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if that works. That's kind of like the survival tactic that I lived with.
Yeah, no, I understand. But this is just my feedback. That kind of flies in the face of what you said about stability.
Yeah.
Stability is about having consistency. And you're advocating that we underfund something some years and boost them up, and then the next, you know, feast famine, which sounds like the opposite of stability. What are your thoughts?
Well, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can just be like a little bit allocated here, or you pull like a little bit from multiple places to fund this.
Sure. So like
that way,
like
no area is hurting too much.
Like say if we wanted to pull, like if we wanted to give 10% more to parks one year to do an investment in something that we all agree is great, like the new pickleball courts, or you know, the new play fields that everyone can use of all income. Like we all agree this is a good idea. Do we then turn to the library and say, guess what? This year, we're taking 10% out of your budget and put it over here. Is that something that you would be in favor of?
You know, and it depends on what the infrastructure looks like socially and community-based.
For sure. So maybe not the libraries. Maybe it's street repair.
Well, even if it was the libraries, like let's say libraries, for instance, right? You know, when I was growing up, I spent most of my time volunteering for the library.
Cool.
And
good for you.
It was like the best.
It's the best. I love libraries in general. Yeah. I was a library kid growing up. I was the nerdy kid in the corner who was going, like, I was reading U.S. News and World Reports cover to cover when I was like 11.
Yeah.
I was that nerdy kid. But I love our library here. My kids use it all the time. Like, it's such an amazing community resource.
Yeah, I do too.
And it would break my heart to see us raid that budget.
Exactly.
To pay something else.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, how can we further get it commuted? Keep it supported. Maybe it means we get all of our nonprofit organizations who are already working in town, because I can tell you right now, they all value the library system.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, having some sort of fundraiser or whatever to help supplement the library's activities and their overhead or whatever, and, you know, toe up the line for just a little bit. And
yeah.
With the right kind of city planning, there are a lot of grants out there, and it's typically lacking the manpower, the human power, the human power to file for those grants and acquire them.
I definitely don't think we've hit our ceiling in how many grants we can apply for. Like, that's something that I think at the city level and with our nonprofits, there's more that could be done. We're also in a climate where federal grants are shrinking, which is tough. But also earlier in this conversation, you mentioned that our nonprofits are already kind of stretched to the max. Hey, the idea of leaning on our nonprofits to backfill a hole in a budget, that doesn't seem consistent.
I think that's a call to action. I think more people really need to get involved. Do you truly care about your community?
I agree. I think the truth is, if we stand around and wait for someone else to do these things, you know, I'm doing this show right now because I was looking around going, I don't see anybody else doing long form interviews with the candidates. So I got the cameras. I got the space. I have the round table. Mm-hmm. Why not? I got this from Surplus, by the way.
Oh, nice.
I think this was at the Cub at one point.
I thought it looked familiar.
Yes. Honestly, it's not the most comfortable to lean on. No. It's kind of sharp, but it also doesn't wobble. So I'm happy.
They don't want you to fall asleep while you're in the middle.
There we go. So going back to the role of city council, what do you believe is the purpose of city council? Like, what is city council for?
First and foremost, for advocates. Advocates for what can be done in the city.
Okay.
What would better the health and cohesiveness of the people in our city?
First and foremost,
we are advocates.
Okay.
Yeah. We are the ones who talk to our constituents, who synthesize the will of the people, because you cannot confuse a government with its people. The people are distinct. And, you know, right now we're seeing a huge grab for power, I think, from a lot of politicians all across the board, not here locally.
Yeah.
I mean, like statewide, nationwide, globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this like conflation between power and control as a dynamic, and what the people need. And that's what a government is there for.
But once you become elected official, you are now part of the power.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So
that's
so,
why you-
So are they separate? Or?
And that's why local government is so important. It's because you are face-to-face with your people.
So going back, what do you believe what does city council do?
I believe, you know, some of the literature that comes across the council members' desks are over 200 pages. Mm-hmm. You know, policy is thick. It's difficult to understand. It's it can be very confusing. Sometimes it doesn't have a clear logic model. I took a oh my gosh, what was this called?
It was a research evaluation course. It was through the Department of Criminology's over at WSU. And my professor was amazing. I mean, I think she really pushed us to take whatever policy it was we were going to focus on and tear it apart. Figure out where it was lacking. How can we fill in the gaps? What doesn't really make sense? Where are there contradictions? And I think that's kind of where City Council comes in. We're advocates in the sense that people tell us that there's an issue and it's our responsibility to go in and say, all right, they've said that there's an issue. We've identified the foundation of that issue or something that may contribute to it. Mm-hmm. And then we do the hard work of going through all of those documents to understand where there might be conflict that could be resolved. You know, conflict's not always a negative thing.
Yeah. You said earlier that in that advocacy, your job is to synthesize that.
Yeah.
What did you mean by synthesize?
So if you are hearing something frequently, like I don't have, or for example, on the WSU campus, not every market accepted SNAP EBT benefits.
Mm.
The one market that did was clear across campus as far as family as far from family housing as you could get.
That's not great.
And you needed a manager to check you out to do it.
That's not great.
It was difficult.
Yeah.
And
that's not equity.
Yeah, it's not equitable at all. And plus the lines are long and, you know, having to ask someone who's checking you out to go get a manager to run the card, it's embarrassing. Yeah. You know, and everybody needs food. If you don't have food, you'll die. You can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have access to it, then you're out of luck.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
So for a while, I was hearing from people who, like, they'd tap me on the shoulder in class. I'm like, I don't know you. And they're like, well, I've seen your work. This is an issue that we have.
Yeah.
And food accessibility was over and over and over and over and over again.
It's a major issue.
It is a huge issue everywhere. Right. You know,
we in a town like this where we're literally surrounded by food production, you'd think we could do a little better. The issue that you brought up, I actually relate with a little bit. Earlier time in my business journey, we were on public assistance.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would get the WIC coupons and my wife would actually choose a time of day to go check out when it wouldn't be as crowded because she knew that the checkers wouldn't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
Have to get a manager. The line gets long and it's embarrassing.
It's paper checks. They're like the size of Texas.
And it takes forever. Like, and every time you go up, it's like it's the first time they're seeing it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't understand how to do this. And so she learned, like, I'm going to do my grocery shopping at 11 o'clock at night when I'm not going to run into any. Like, the struggle is real. The struggle is real. That was at Walmart, which the city council has no purview over. You mentioned WSU, right? Which not a lot of city council can do that. What do you believe the city's role should be in addressing things like food security?
I think if enough people are saying that there's an issue, then we have to find a way. You know, there's a
loop. Like, what are some specific applications that are under the city government's purview?
So I think it may not necessarily be done through legislature, but using our voices is also really important.
Yeah.
And as city council members, we have a platform and a privilege to bring light to certain things. So, like, I would love to see if there's any excess honey coming out of the production of our bees on the campus. You know, where does that honey go? Is there any excess that could go into our food banks?
Yeah.
I would love to see an agreement with big corporations where if you've got waste, which oftentimes is good food, and the only reason that they're throwing it away is because the packaging is out of date, not necessarily the food is expired.
Right.
Like, I want to see an agreement between these big investors contributing back to our city. If they don't sell everything in time, and, you know, we don't have that timeline as community members, so, you know, but having that go to the community instead of into the bin just seems reasonable.
Absolutely. And there's tons of opportunities like that.
Yeah.
So I want to yes and something you said. A little bit of pushback, but really I want to build on what you said, because you're describing advocacy of making these connections. The truth is you're already doing that now. And there's a lot more that you might do in the future. In some ways, you might be more successful at advocating for those non-city business items. Mm-hmm. You actually might have more of a voice, more of a platform as a
regular citizen than you do as an elected official, because the job of the city, of the city council, at least from a legal standpoint, is two things: write policy, pass policy, like pass laws, and set the budget. That's it, right? Like the city council does not run the city. The city council doesn't get to go and tell the parking people, hey, waive these fines. Like, that's not how the structure chart works. The city council is to the mayor as the state legislature is to the government, to the governor. Like, it's that kind of relationship. And so when you talk about it being first and foremost a platform, I go, well, I'm not sure that is the purpose, but also I'm all about people using their platform. Like, you have a platform now. So what would be different once you're in city council? Like, would you still see this as primarily a platform for activism, or are you looking forward to getting involved in the work and the minutia of governing through lawmaking?
Yeah. So as you said, policy writing is a part of the position, right?
It's the primary.
It's the primary part of the position. And so when I said, you know, research evaluation has a part to play here. Yeah. If you hear something over and over again and you find the policy that is in the works, making sure that you write comprehensive policy to support what they need or what they're asking for, you know, to make sure that you're meeting the standards of these social determinants of health, you know, that protect our community.
Yeah,
of course. And but having that platform really helps, because if you close yourself off, if you're not out there speaking to people, if you're not out there telling people what you believe in and nobody's pushing back, how are you going to know what to look for?
Yeah. Yeah.
So everything you do when you're engaging with your people, using your platform and your privilege, that should be helping you construct policy.
Yeah.
It should tell you where to look.
Yeah. It just gets interesting when you end up in situations where the city actually doesn't have oversight.
Yeah.
Like an example that we've seen talked about on Nextdoor in the last week, and you had some excellent comments about it, was governance of the hospital. You know, we are blessed to not have an investor-owned hospital locally. They don't answer to shareholders. They don't answer to, you know, some big angel investor. They actually answer to the people, and it is a governmental agency, a hospital district, but that is distinct from city council.
Yes.
And so, you know, when we talk about health issues in the community, I think there's a lot of things that a city government can do. Telling the hospital who to hire probably isn't one of them.
Probably not.
So like in that situation, where do you feel like the line is for advocacy from the platform? You know, like, I'm city councilor, now I can advocate for the, you know, where's the line between city business and not city business?
Should there be a line between what city council members are involved with in terms of our hospital?
That's my question to you.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what is your worldview about what's appropriate for an elected official?
I think if it's important to us, we should always be involved regardless.
Sure.
So I don't know if you've attended one of those meetings before. I've attended one of those meetings, and I chatted with a couple of the people who sit and
hospital commissioners.
Yeah, the hospital board of commissioners, and you know, I've a lot of the concerns they have align with the concerns that I had.
Awesome.
And so when you go into these meetings, you may not be looking to change these people's minds, but rather, you know, I feel it's also their responsibility to, in a sense, write policy for their purview.
Sure.
Right? For the hospital. And if you're the person who's coming to them saying, I've heard this issue over and over again, and you push it and you make sure that they hear you, well, then, now you're playing into advocacy. You're synthesizing the will of the people.
Yeah.
Right? You're making sure that you're using your platform and privilege to alert administrators who may not see it, may not encounter it, or may not have any experience with it at all, to look and say, okay, well, maybe we need to do something a little bit differently. And one of the things that I brought up was, you know, what is your relationship with the WSU students who are coming out of our nursing program and our psych programs? And, you know, like, do you have an agreement of some sort? And I think they offer like internships, and I think they lean into some other grants that help keep rural hospitals afloat.
Yeah.
You know, it's also been a hot minute, so I can't say that's still true. I need to go back. But, you know, like, their focus is not so far from what we want to see as a community.
Yeah.
And so I think it is important to show up to those things and put yourself in those situations to say, I've heard this over and over again.
Right.
Where can I help you work on fixing that? What do you need from me? Can you do it on your own? You know,
how else can we help? Do you need involvement here from these other people? They can't get you connected with somebody. I've got their email right here. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that has happened where it's like, I want to organize something, or I hear somebody else wants to organize something. And it's literally a matter of, oh, let me get you connecting.
Yeah. Would you say there's any issue that would be out of bounds for a city councilor to use their platform to push? Regardless of whether or not you agree with it, is there anything that you think like that's not appropriate for a city council to use a, you know, use the bully pulpit to like,
yeah,
go off on it?
I think mudslinging is also is always a hard stop for me.
Sure.
I think critiquing certain policies and the way certain things are done is really important. Mm-hmm. But I think calling somebody out specifically just to drag their name through the mud is really
that's just like the baseline of human decency.
Yeah.
What about like issues? Are there any issues that you think would be out of bounds for a city councilor? Or like if your thing is like, man, I am really passionate about nuclear disarmament, and I'm going to use my position in the Pullman City Council in Pullman, Washington, to talk about nuclear disarmament. Like, is that, I'm using a crazy example.
I mean, is that so crazy? So there,
I'm asking you, like, is it all on the table? And is that like, if you become an elected official with your worldview, is it like, this is your moment? You now have a platform where you get, it's like being given the talk show on the radio. Like, this is your chance to talk about anything.
Well, as you know, I have not only spent my life in the U.S., I've lived in a lot of different places.
Which I think is valuable to have that kind of experience and diversity in our community.
Yeah, I would agree. Because I can say absolutely 100% the decisions we make here locally affect people on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And I think it is extremely important that we recognize what our position is in the greater scheme of globalization.
Yeah.
Because just because we can't see it doesn't mean we don't have a hand in it. I went to a conference on archaeology and there was a very particular group that was giving a symposium, and it was talking about how can we put more missile silos on indigenous land and convince them to just give it up to us. I mean, these are
saying the quiet part out loud there.
Yeah. I mean, like, these are conversations that are happening behind closed doors and people sanction it. And we should be saying stuff like that out loud, no matter who we are. It doesn't matter what my platform is or what kind of privilege I have. Yeah. The fact that I do have the privilege to be out here televised, you know, hopefully no one comes for me after I said that. But I guess I should welcome it. I would welcome it. And they would probably hear my opinion about it very strongly.
And that's good. Like, no, the good thing is, we still have free speech. No one's being muzzled on what they can say, you know, as a private citizen and all that, which is awesome. But time and resources are finite.
Time and resources are finite.
And the amount of time that city council has to do the business of governing is also finite. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of tension between how much do we focus on the business of legislating for Pullman, mm-hmm. and how much time do we spend advocating for stuff that may not be in our control.
I think once we get to that point of resiliency where we feel comfortable, I mean, like, for the first time in my life living here in the Palouse, I feel comfortable about my food supply because I've worked hard on it.
Awesome.
Right. I have that stability, which gives me a lot more bandwidth to do a ton of other things and talk about issues that are also important to me. You know, like, I can dip into making Guido's new recovery center and volunteer. I can, I'm emceeing at Bruce Books for their poetry slam. And, you know, it's like I have finally reached a position of stability where I can focus on things that I've wanted to, that might be bigger than me. And I can use my voice to advocate for things that I feel are very important, that we all have a direct contribution to, you know. We can say we weren't responsible for enslaved persons. You know, we may not actively have slaves working our land, but there are mechanisms in play within our community that still foster a lot of the infrastructure. And, you know, while we don't have a direct hand in starting it, we do have a responsibility to address it and build out of that. And, you know, I think that there are issues that are bigger than us that we should take the time to address. And if I have the bandwidth to do it, and I think if my other, you know, city officials have the bandwidth to do it, then they should. That's their privilege.
Awesome. Well, as we wrap up here, tell me a little bit about what you see as the future you hope to see in Pullman. 5, 10, 15 years from now, how do you hope we have grown and progressed as a community?
It is my hope and dream that at some point we have done such a good job that our community members, all of our community members have the time and the accessibility to come together at local events and really learn from each other, have conversations with each other, you know, share food. Oh, like, I mean, obviously food is my passion. It's like the crux of everything. But, you know, I want us to get to a point where we do feel stable enough to take the time to come together and not feel ire. Like, I mean, conflict is always going to be there. And it's important that it is. Because if you don't have conflict, then you can never have growth. And, you know, I think metaphysical growth, emotional growth is a lot more important than economic growth sometimes. And right now, that you can get that economic stability and that community stability by leaning into socializing with each other and learning who each other is and what the other person needs. And I think that with my background and all the places that I've been, I've lived in extremely red areas down the street from the Grand Dragon of the KKK, where they did protests on the street corner, you know, for quite some time. It's where my father grew up. It was a prison town. I mean, like, you get a certain culture that grows there, and each place that I've been to has had its own unique culture, and I've never found one where I truly hated the people. I mean, we are not our governments. We are humans. We each have our own identities and we have the capacity to care for each other. But right now things are so strained, it feels impossible to do. So it's my hope that one day, you know, we can have our own individual identities and lean into that and have that be a beautiful thing. Yeah, we all came from a struggle. I think a lot of us came from a struggle, some of us less than others. But that struggle is shared and flourishing is mutual. So
it's beautiful.
Thanks.
Shay, thank you so much for sitting down with me. This was a pleasure, and wish you best of luck in the primary election.
I appreciate that. And thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's been fun. Yeah. Thank you.